Hi, my name is Jerry Jones. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
I want to thank Lee for having me here and all of you for being here. And if you think I'm going to screw that up by talking any further, you're wrong. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January the 1st, 1973, for which I'm very grateful. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a lot of other things. I'm a recovering lawyer. I haven't sent a bill or subpoenaed anybody in several years now. I was subject to Al-Anon supervision several years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to meet the supervisor, my wife, Billy. We've been married a while, 54 years, huh? I like to think I've been married since the mind of man remembereth not. I didn't do well under Al-Anon supervision for a while, but I've improved. I really have. And Al-Anon certainly did a lot to help me get to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It took away a lot of the resistance to what I was doing and left me to flop around in my own juices, which wasn't exactly a pleasant experience. And anyway, I decided I was an alcoholic. You know what? The book tells us what an alcoholic is. Alcoholism is a disease or a condition, the book calls it. It's made up of an allergy to alcohol. And I think an allergy is an abnormal physical reaction to a known substance. It says that we have an obsession. And when I have an obsession, I'm dealing with my mind. Alcoholism, it says, centers in the mind. When I take a drink, the craving that I have kicks off, and my brain thinks, I believe I will have another one of those. and another one until I've had far too many. The obsession kicks in when, no matter what the circumstance I encounter, I think a drink would improve this. It can be a wedding, a ball, a funeral, whatever the hell comes down the road, a drink would improve this situation. Now, it wasn't always that way with me. I must have drank for a week or two before I started having that problem. I'm going to talk to you tonight about the first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and my experience. I'm also going to tell you that the 12 steps and the 12 traditions points out, and you can find in the first several chapters of the big book, descriptions of what alcoholics go through trying to recognize that they have an obsession. And until you and I, as alcoholics, find a way to live to defeat that obsession, we're not going to get sober. We're going to drink. As a matter of fact, I believe that unless you reach a bottom in almost any change in your life, major change in your life, you're not going to change. I grew up right in West Texas. My mother and dad were God-fearing, hard-working, good people. They didn't have any problem with alcohol until they got me up. Then they began to have some problems along with it. And I had a good set of values taught to me. I knew right from wrong, and I knew to be honest and to be truthful, and I knew they taught me well. And when I got a little older, I began to make some modifications to the values. I began to do what I needed to make me happier, what I thought I needed to make me happy. And it was that pursuit of what I needed that ultimately led me to alcohol, I think, and what ultimately led me totally away from some of the values that I had been taught and really believed were important. Every time I got away from those values, drunk or sober, my self-esteem suffered. I didn't always recognize that, and I was not a person that you would have said walked around feeling like he was less than. I put on the big front. I was more than. And I never wanted to be a loser. I always wanted to be a winner. But when you don't want to be a loser, when that's the way you frame it, you really think you may be a loser. And you have a tendency to try to cover that up. I wanted to be a man. But when I measured myself against some guys that I thought really were men, I was a little insecure. I remember my dad one time, he was working on a plow. And he had a nut on that plow that he was trying to loosen up to take a bolt, a plowshare off or something. And it was rusted up and he couldn't make it work. So he had a chisel and a hammer. He was going to cut it off. And he was whacking the bejeebies out of that chisel, and he hit it a little crooked and hit his hand and busted his hand, and his blood went everywhere. And he got up and slung his hand around a little bit and said some words that I'd been told you're not supposed to say at all. And but that is okay for men to do that, apparently. And he finally found the chisel and he picked it up again, and he said, started to go back and hammer it again. And I said, "Daddy, did that hurt?" And he looked at me and said, "Hell no." A few days later, I was playing being a man. I played being a man a lot. I knew what I was going to be when I was a man. I was going to be like my daddy. And I got me a little chisel and a hammer. And I began to hammer the hell out of it. And sure enough, it slipped and I hit my hand. Guess what? Hurt like hell. Not only did it hurt, but I cried a little, which was a very unmanly thing to do. Wasn't anybody around, and I'm out there bawling. And then I was afraid to do it anymore. So I thought, well, now, you know, comparing myself to my dad, you ain't a man yet. You're not a man. And so you grow up trying to be something you really think you're not. You try to be a winner so you won't be thought of as a loser. And I wasn't aware of these things at the time this was going on. I found these things after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't aware about alcoholism at all until I got here. This thing about alcoholism, it moves you around. You start off here and you wind up way out here. And you do things that don't make a hell of a lot of sense. When I was a kid out there on the farm, I had a dog. And my dog gave me an experience one time that helps describe alcoholism about as well as I can. My dog's name was Patches. He was mostly an English bulldog. And he was kind of a celebrity in the local area because he had got in a fight with a badger. And badgers are bad news for dogs. And he had that badger weighed a pound more than he did. We know because he finally killed that badger, and we weighed them both. And the badger had him by a pound, but Patches had him by his life. Just to give you a little insight to his personality, Patches would go up in the field every day for about a week after that and pick up that old dad badger and just shake the hell out of it, just to let him know that he was still there in case if there's reincarnation or anything like that, by God, come on back, we're ready. This particular day, he was laying in the front yard of our place. Dad's in the shop working, and Mom's working around the kitchen, and I'm tooling around doing nothing. And he's laying there. He's happy. He's a hero. He's loved. He's well-fed. He's got no problems that anybody can see. Maybe a fly buzzing around his ear or something, but nothing serious. And into our yard walked a neighbor's boar hog, big, ugly boar hog. Patches made a decision Bulldogs do not make decisions lightly. He decided to get hold of the hog. And when he decided to get hold of the hog and got hold of the hog, it was not a temporary thing. He's locked down and hanging on. The hog doesn't particularly like this, and the hog's squealing, the dog's barking and growling. It's chaos in the barnyard. Everybody was happy until just a minute ago, and here it goes, by God. Finally, the hog drags him alongside the barn, and he comes off. And as he did that, the hog turned around, and he had a big yellow tusk, and he hooked him with those tusks and cut his shoulder pretty good. Dad got there about that time. And he caught Patches before Patches could re-engage and was holding him, and he was picking him up, and the dog was snapping and snarling, and he wanted that hog bad. And the hog was pretty happy. He'd been turned loose now. He didn't have much of an argument with anybody. Dad took him over to the water hydrant and poured water on him and sent me to the barn to get some pine tar, and we put some pine tar to stop the bleeding. And we all took a deep breath. It's okay. Dust has settled. No problem. So we turned Patches loose. He went right back and got hold of that hog again. And it was the same thing. There was barking and squealing. My dad was out there kicking and cussing hogs and dogs. And I'm out there trying to get in the mess of trying to fix it. My mother's come running out of the house. And she sees her kid getting into this hog-dog thing going on. And ain't no, everybody in the barnyard's got a problem. We all got a problem. Everybody there knows the solution to the problem. Hog knows it. We know it. Everybody knows it except Patches. The solution is turn loose the damned hog. Turn him loose. Well, he came off again, and Dad caught him again. And this time he tied him up to the water hydrant, cooled him off, got in the pickup, and drove the hog off to the neighbor's place, left me to counsel with my dog. And for a while I sat with him and asked him deep and penetrating questions, you know. Patches, have you ever had a good day getting hold of hogs? Does getting hold of hogs create any problems with your family? How do they taste? Do you like the taste of hogs? Is there an after effect? Does getting hold of hogs ever hurt you? And I went through this whole deal. And in about 2 hours or an hour, whatever it was, I cured him. He was laying on the ground. His tongue was hanging out like that smile they got on her face, and his tongue hanging out. And he's not pulling on the chain anymore, and he looks happy. So I go to my father, the warden, and say, Patches is, while we've committed him to the water hydrant, he's okay now. Dad says, well, I've had a little trouble with that dog this morning. I think I'll look at him. So he came down, looked at him, walked around him, scratched his ear. Everything was good. Turned fine. Problem's done, right? Turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find that hog the next time. Now, you may identify with one of the players in that. Personally, I was one of the first hogginons in West Texas. I was raised right at the... I was 10 years old when World War II came along, and all the physical, able-bodied men went to war. And they left the farms to boys like me and fathers like my dad who had rheumatoid arthritis and couldn't go to war. And I grew up real quick. I had a lot of responsibility thrust on me. Not that I was unique at all, because all my classmates had the same kind of experience. But I started out young with a lot of responsibility, and my dad was a real hard taskmaster. You didn't mess around with Clarence. When Clarence told you to do something, that was the way it was going to be, and you might just well do it. But then I found irresponsibility as a cure for responsibility. Just by God, let the good times roll. Don't let anybody think you're even trying to make the honor roll. Just raise hell. Become woolly, wild and woolly and full of fleas and never curried below the knees. Lover and a fighter and a wild horse rider. and a right smart of a windmill hand, too. That's what my goal in life was to be when I was off that tractor and away from Clarence. And when I got to college, I found a thing called alcohol that fit right in that, just like a glove. And I went through 4 years of college. My wife came to college there. She didn't have much to do with me when I was in college. I had sort of a speckled reputation in college. I wasn't on the honor roll, and I didn't go to a lot of classes. But my wife and I had some classes together, and we kind of had a deal. I would loan her my car when she needed one, and she would give me her notes. It's hard to pass a class. I sold all my books the day after I bought them because, well, we were going to have a party, and I didn't have any ready cash, so you just sell your books. What the hell? You ain't going to read them anyway. Why not sell the damn thing? So she would loan me her notes, and I could get enough out of those notes, and a few times I went to class to pass, and that was good enough for me. And I tried to date her. I saw her when she got there, right off the bus from California. Good-looking broad. I needed her in my life. And as the Bible says of me, she would have none. But I graduated a year before. I didn't intend to graduate from college. Had no intention. Why would you ever want to leave a place like the college? They bring a new crop of freshman girls in every year, and it's just fantastic. But I did. I went to the Navy, went to Officers Candidate School, came back through wearing my uniform, looked pretty good. She thought it looked pretty good. She thought I had grown up. So we corresponded while I was in the Navy, and after I'd been overseas 1 year, I came back and we got married. And she had some kind of goofy idea, I don't know what it was, that I was going to quit drinking when we got married. I promise you, I never even hinted at that. I love to drink. I got started in college, and I just loved it. I could get positively excited about getting drunk a week from tonight. I'd plan it. I'd think, God, we're going to pool our money, going to buy some gasoline for somebody's car. We're going to take the rest of it and get somebody to buy us booze or con some liquor store owner out of booze or shoplift a little booze, however you get it, but get some booze and let the good times roll. And right away, I had some problems that I didn't know, or I thought everybody had. I had blackouts. Oftentimes, the first question most people ask when we woke up in the car the next morning was, where are we? Nobody had a real answer to that for a while. Then somebody would say, what did we do? And I never was able to add much to that because I didn't remember. I thought everybody blacked out. And we'd put together some kind of story about, and they told me I did some things. Wasn't sure I'd done those things. Didn't seem like the kind of things that I ought to do. But they said I did them. And but I was always the guy that said, let's do that again. Let's do that again. And I kept about three or four groups of people partying most of the time. And it didn't stop when I was in the Navy. We came into port every once in a while, and I drank pretty heavy then. Got married, as I said, and we got out of the Navy and went to law school. And I didn't drink much there because my thinker wouldn't work if I was drinking. And I needed to think if I was going to stay in law school. I had a little kid by that time, and I was a hungry young man. We were poor as church mice, and I was humping to get through law school. And I didn't drink much except between semesters. And I could party a little between semesters. And Billy said that was the first time she did recognize that she had a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde on her hands, because she'd go to the party with one guy and come home with another. And I went through a long period of time here now that most sane people would recognize as that you got a problem. My wife always talked about my problem. She was pretty much obsessed with my problem. So much so that I recognized that she had some sort of neurosis or something about alcohol. And I sent her to a psychiatrist. And she was sick enough, she went. She was looking for help anywhere she could get it. After a while, they asked for me, and I went a few times, but it was obviously nothing I could do that would help out here. I didn't recognize it as alcohol being the problem. It was my wife's reaction to alcohol that has the problem. And the guy told her she needed to loosen up a little bit. She needed not to spend quite so much money and drink a little wine. They told me about drinking a little wine. I bought her any kind of wine she wanted. I mean, I stocked the place with wine. And we rocked along. We fought a lot. Maybe every day almost. And it was always surrounded by alcohol, but alcohol was not the problem. It was my wife's reaction to alcohol and me that was causing the damn problem. I would have been happy if my wife would just get off my back. And she, as a untreated Al-Anon, would have been happy if I just stopped drinking, if he would just stop drinking. Of course, we both suffered from alcoholism. We both suffered from the disease of alcoholism. I had a few little incidents that were kind of embarrassing. And I would, when I had one of those, I'd just make a policy decision not to go back there anymore. And when you drank as long as I did in Dallas, Texas, there were just a lot of places you wouldn't go back to anymore. We had a little deals at home that from time to time caused kind of a problem. I smoked heavily. And I was an automatic smoker. When I swung my feet over the side of the bed, I reached out with my left hand and I knew exactly where the cigarettes and my lighter were. And I'd light it up. And sometimes my wife would put me to bed without taking me to the bathroom. Terrible mistake to make. So I'd swing out of bed and I'd light my cigarette. I used it to kind of guide me around the house. You know, there's just from outward appearances, there's not a lot of difference between a bathroom and a closet. And at night, when you're a little bit drunk, it's kind of hard to tell which is which sometimes. And I would come back, and when I got my business taken care of, and wherever I got it taken care of, and sit on the edge of the bed and finish my cigarette a lot of times. But I don't know about you, but drinking made me tired. I would get about halfway through that cigarette, and I think I'll just lay back on the couch, on the pillow here, and finish this cigarette up. And I did that one night, and I woke up a little later. And there was a pretty good-sized fire going on my side of the bed. And I got up, and we put out the fire. And I don't remember where I slept because it was wet on my side of the bed. And the next morning, I got up, and I didn't stay in the house long. I shaved quickly, went out the door, and as I went out the door, I said, buy any kind of bed you want. I was generous to a fault. And I came home, and she had written me a letter. She said, Dear Jerry, I've been talking to you about your smoking and your drinking. I am no longer able to go to bed at night without worrying about my life and the life of our children because of your smoking and drinking. You must do something about your smoking and drinking. And I told you I was a responsible guy. I quit smoking, by God. Well, alcohol doesn't cause fires. So, I quit smoking and I had a lot of willpower. I kept a package of cigarettes right there beside me all the time because I knew if I ever deprived myself of the opportunity to smoke, I would go get some damn cigarettes. So I left it there and I never smoked another cigarette. Lots of willpower. I tried, my wife did some strange things. Without my permission, sometimes she did things that were kind of causing a problem in our family. She began to be absent at times when I needed her. I didn't care much where she was except when I needed her. And when I wanted her there, I wanted her right beside my chair. And she, one night I needed her, or day at time, I don't remember what time it was, and I said, "Answer it." Anyway, she wasn't there. My daughter was around, and I said, "Where's your mother?" She said, "I don't know, Daddy." I said, "Where do you think your mother is?" And she said, "Well, I don't know, Daddy. She may have gone to one of those meetings." I said, "What kind of meeting is that?" And she said, "I don't know, Daddy. It's a family meeting." At this particular point in time, my wife and I had decided that we were almost an irresolvable conflict, and we were going to get a divorce in 6 months if we were not better. And it occurred to me when my daughter talked about my wife going to family meetings that I didn't know about, that I probably needed a representative present at those meetings. There was no telling what the hell they were doing there, and I needed to know. So when she came in, I cross-examined her a little. I was a pretty good trial lawyer, and I cross-examined a lot of people, but my wife is the most difficult witness I ever cross-examined. She's difficult because she will not lie, but she will not give you any more information than she absolutely has to. And I could always tell when that was going to happen because when she, you know, right early in the conversation, she walked in, I said, "Where have you been?" And she said, "Out." "It's going to be a long night." "Out." "Out where?" And she said, to the shopping center. I said, "Which one, Preston?" "What'd you do there?" "Oh, met some friends." "Who were they?" "You wouldn't know them." "What did you do there with your friends?" "Oh, we just shared our experience, strength, and hope." And I realized it's going to be a while before I get the whole story here, so I started narrowing the field and cutting off the exits and narrowing the field. Finally, I got a word. Never heard this word before. Al-Anon. Al-Anon. What would be an Al-Anon? Now, we were pretty deep in the conversation by now, and things got a little heated, and I did not want to appear ignorant. So I made my best guess. And I thought it probably was an aluminum kitchen utensil. It's not. And then she began to tell me, the floodgates opened. She began to tell me what this thing was, this wonderful organization that, God, you'd pay $500 a seat if you knew how good it was, that anybody was welcome. The only requirement for membership was that you have a friend or family member who had a problem with alcohol. Ding! She has taken my supposed problem to a public meeting. I've just made senior partner in the largest law firm in Dallas, and we've already got two alcoholic lawyers in that firm. I think that's a full compliment. I don't think they want any more. Matter of fact, they've been talking about getting rid of the ones they got. I sobered up almost immediately, and I set her down in a chair, and I gazed deeply into her eyes, and I said, "Listen, Billy, you must not go to any more of those meetings." And she said, "Jerry, I think I need to go." And I said, "Billy, have you noticed I'm the only one that brings any money to this house?" Yeah, she knew that. I said, "Do you know we owe money on the furniture, on the cars, on the house? We owe money everywhere." "Yes." "Do you know what happens when you don't pay the monthly sum you're supposed to pay?" "What happens?" "Well, they come get it. Whether it's the house, the car, the furniture, they're going to take it all away because when they find out downtown that you think I'm an alcoholic, they're going to fire me that day. And I'm going to leave, and we're not going to have any money. And we're not talking about kids' college educations now. We're talking about being naked on the streets of Dallas with our children in the middle of the damn winter. She said, I think I need to go. And I said, Billy, please do not go. And she said, I think I'm going to go. Then I said, well, if you go to another one of them damn meetings and I find out about it, I'll kill you just sure as hell. And I didn't kill her, and she kept going. She was, they when they get hold of them, they're hard to get out of there, I'll tell you that. I tried everything. I tried to bribe her. I tried to beg her. I tried to threaten her. I tried everything. And I'd go to work in the morning, I think, well, it's today the day they're going to call me in and say, we understand your wife thinks you're an alcoholic. We wondered about you. You're out. And they wouldn't say anything. And I'd think, oh, boy, I made it through another day. And I'd go home, and I'd think, I got to get that woman out of here. Got to get her out of Alabama. And I'd pick fights. I don't know. You probably don't do that. But I would pick fights. I would decide before I got home, we're going to have a fight tonight. And the way I'm kind of sneaky this way. I would try to get her to admit all the things I was going to need to win the fight. And that way, and then she'd find out she was in a fight, and I had her admissions, and so I'd done a pretty good job of entrapment there. And so I walked in, gave her a little kiss on the cheek. She was cooking supper. I said, oh, it smells good. Dinner smells good. She said, thank you. I said, how are the kids? The kids okay? Yeah. Have a good day at school? Yeah, they did. How's the dog? Is dog good? Dog's good, yeah. I said, Billy, I've been thinking. You think I'm an alcoholic. And she said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, it's damn funny. You've called me an alcoholic for years. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. It's really hard to get something going when they're acting like this, I won't tell you that. And those answers took me totally by surprise. And I said, well, you've been calling me an alcoholic for years. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. She said, I don't, it doesn't matter, nothing I can say about whether you are or not an alcoholic that makes any difference. It doesn't matter what I think, what the children think, what your bosses think, what your mother and father thinks. It doesn't matter what anybody in the world thinks except you. And if you don't think you're an alcoholic, you'll never do anything about it. And I made a mistake that no good trial lawyer ever make. I asked a question when I didn't have a goose's idea what the answer was. I said, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? And the jaws of the Al-Anon trap closed just like that. She said, well. I've read a book. It's written by a lady called Marty Mann, and she was the first woman member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that book, it's called The Primer on Alcoholism. They say there's a way to take a little test to find out whether you're alcoholic or not. She said, the first way is you can just quit drinking. But I don't think you want to do that. And I said, right. She said, the other way is you can take this little test and you take 2 drinks a day, every day, no more, no less, but 2 drinks every day for 6 months. And if you never exceed 2 drinks a day during that 6 months period, in all probability, you are not an alcoholic. And I said, let me understand this. You've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years, and now you're telling me it's okay to go ahead for 6 more months. She said, that's right. And I realized I'm dealing with a sick woman here. There's something. This makes no logical sense at all. So I got the hell out of there. But that thing stuck in my head. I didn't want a divorce. I love my kids and I love my family. I didn't want a divorce. But I had invited her several times. If she wanted to leave, she could. I'd just keep the house and the kids and everything would be all right. She turned that down on a fairly regular basis. And so I decided that a day or two later that somebody's going to have to try to save this damn family. Looks like this old Watash is going to have to make the sacrifice. So I decided, well, I'll take the damn test. Never occurred to me. I never had any idea that I never tried to limit my drinking. I drank what I wanted or when I needed it. And I started taking the test. I had to change it just a little. I had a pretty good glass, pretty good sized glass. And I decided what I'm going to do is drink two martinis before dinner. My martinis didn't have but very little vermouth in them. And I'll drink those two. And then I would eat dinner. She was always trying to get me to eat. And I would eat dinner, and then I would switch to brandy after dinner. And I'd have one big brandy with just a little splash of soda in it, because gentlemen drink brandy after dinner. And then I, by God, would switch to coffee. And that's the way I would end my day. And I started trying to take the test. My recovery started right there. I would drink that first martini and begin to feel my shoulders loosen up a little bit, you know. I'd get about halfway through the second one, and the music would start. Da 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 da. And I'd step out of the phone booth, you know. It was always pretty much the same. I'd think, well, that's about all the martinis today. And this thing inside my head would say, what are you doing? What are you doing? Who has to deal with all those judges, crooked lawyers, unreasonable clients, all that pressure every day? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer was, hell no. So I'd drink the bottle. The next night I'd come in and it'd be a different day. And it'd been a bad day though. And I'd walk up to the bar and I'd think, start to take the damn test, you know. And I'd think, well, hell with it. I ain't taking no damn test today. It's been a bad day. Or I could forget it. Could forget the damn test, except she had a sponsor from hell. This lady told her the way she should start each day was the moment she awakened, the moment she became conscious, to say out loud and firmly, this is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it. Now, when you've had a quart of whiskey the night before, somebody mentioned their eye, having getting their eye back. Mine, I'd get it propped open and I'd have a case of dry eye. You couldn't open it, you couldn't close it. It just stayed there for a while. Your heart was beating in your ears for some reason, just whoom, and the pain in your head was very bad. You had a thick layer of something on your tongue, about a quarter of it. You could have shaved your tongue. And you hear that statement made, you're reasonably sure you're not going to rejoice a hell of a lot that day. But I tried the test. I gave the test a fair chance. I ran it a year and a half. Never passed it once. I won't. And it whipped me like I've never been whipped in my life. On December 31st, 1972, we were going to have some people go out. We were going to go out to dinner with a couple of people, two couples, and and we're going to have dinner, and we're going to come back to my house to bring in the new year. I know why we're going to bring back to my house, because I got out recently and got a little drunk, and it was hard to get me back home again. So now we're going to catch it early and get him in the house. And I started December 31st, to, just like any other day, had a cup of coffee and kind of read the paper a little bit. And then I decided it was didn't have to work that day. I might as well have a little toddy. So I got up and mixed me a little toddy, and she saw it. And she said, "Remember, tonight is the night we're going out to dinner. Remember?" I said, "I got it. I got it. Don't worry about it. I got it." And I paced myself through the day. This was a big challenge for me, and I'm going to handle this just right. I can get drunk, but I got to wait till I get home to get drunk. I remember waking up in my chair, and I looked out the window, and it was totally pitch black. And I looked over, and she's wearing her robe, sitting in a little chair, reading a little book. They read lots of little books. She changed a lot. She quit fighting me about drinking. And I said, "Billy, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go to dinner?" And she said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" And I looked at the clock. It was about 10:15. I'd passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had not one excuse in the world. I wasn't mad at anybody. I had no pressure on me. There wasn't a reason in the world for me to be passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when I've been trying to control my drinking all day long. And I got up and walked to the bar and made myself a big drink. I knew she'd call those people and said, we can't go to dinner. And oh, by the way, you can't come over here after you've had dinner either. And probably, she said, being a black belt Al-Anon by that time, Jerry's passed out in his chair again. She never has confessed to that, but I kind of think that's what she did. They didn't come. And I got what I wanted. I wanted oblivion. And I woke up on January the 1st, 1973. And I sat on the edge of the bed. And I was at a bottom. I was at a place where I had no idea what to do. I sat there and I thought, what are my options this year? Got a new year here now. Last year was a catastrophe. I had all kinds of problems. The walls were closing in on me. My partners were asking me about my drinking. Everything was looking down. And what are my options? I tried everything I knew to control my drinking, and I couldn't do it. So the only other thing I could think of was to quit drinking. So I took a shower and cleaned up and went in and apologized to my wife for the night before. She was not impressed with my apology. She hardly answered me at all. And then I said, "Billy, I'm going to try to quit drinking." She was impressed by that. She said, "Wonderful." She ran over to the bookcase and just happened to have a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And a little 24-hour day book. And she came trotting them over to me and she said, "Would you like for me to call somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "Hell no. I got myself in this damn mess, and if anybody's going to get me out, by God, it'll be old Watash here. I'll do it." And she said something loving in Al-Anon like, "You got it," and turned around and walked off. And I had had it. I didn't know I'd had it, but I'd had it. And I don't know about you, but when you're doing something bad for yourself, you know, like drinking, and you quit, shouldn't it get better? I didn't. I got quick. I couldn't sleep. I was never in the right place. If I was sitting down, I ought to be standing up. If I'm standing up, I ought to be walking. If I'm walking, I ought to be outside walking. If I'm outside walking, I ought to be inside laying down. I'm moving and grooving, you know. And nobody is giving me any solace at all. She's just going on with her life like nothing's going on at all. at the end of the second day. I realized that, you know, if this thing doesn't get any better tomorrow, I'm going to drink. I'm going to have a damn drink. So I sneaked in the kitchen. I knew she'd leave them damn books laying around there somewhere for me to find. There'd all been all kinds of literature left for me for years. I knew the book would be there, and I found the little book. I'm sorry I didn't read conference-approved literature. But I got the 24-hour-a-day book, and I opened it to January the 2nd. And I read about it. It says, alcohol has ruined your life. And I said, hell yes. Yes, sir. It said, this year we're going to turn our drinking problem over to God and leave it there. I can't tell you how disappointed I was in what you AAs had in mind. It was just, how are you going to find God? I've been looking for God all my life, and I can't find him. Now, I threw that little book out in the middle of the table, and I don't know why I did what I did then. But I said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. No use going in all the way at once, you know. So, I decided I'd call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got the most insensitive human being I'd ever met on the phone. A woman. Hello, Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, my name is Jerry. I may have some sort of a drinking problem. And I'm having a little trouble staying off the booze. And she said, how many meetings are you going to? I said, I haven't been to any meetings. I went to one about a week or 10 days ago, but I wasn't much interested in that. And she said, well, you're going to have to go to a meeting every day. And I said, wait a minute, you don't understand. I'm a fairly big-time lawyer, and I don't have time to go to all those damn meetings you're talking about. A meeting a day? And she said, well, what have you been doing in the evening? I said, well, I've been drinking. I've been telling you that is what I've been doing. She said, well, now that you've stopped, you're going to have some free time, aren't you? So I said, okay, what do you got? And she gave me some suggestions, and finally we settled on a little home meeting. I wanted a very quiet one near a country club. All college graduates, if I could. And I knew I was getting nowhere because she said, we ain't got none of them. And anyway, that was my entry into Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a few weeks later, I ran across a guy in AA, and he was just out of a treatment center. I'd gone to this little home meeting, but they had years of sobriety. And I couldn't imagine how you could stay sober as long as they had if they felt like I did. And he came in, he had literature in every pocket. God, he was smart about alcoholism. He'd been in treatment center for 4 or 5 months because something about not doing a fourth step, whatever the hell that was. I guess it's some kind of a dance, I'm not sure. Anyway, I walked out after the meeting and I said, David, I said, what do you think about this AA and A thing we got here? He said, that ain't for us. I said, those are nice people. We said, we're going to have to go to a meeting every day. We're going to have to get sponsors. We're going to have to help make coffee, whatever the hell good that would do. And we're going to have to change the way we think. And he was, I believed him. He was still quick. We sat there and looked at each other, and we knew we were dealing with a real alcoholic. And the miracle happened to me because I said, where are we going to go? He had been in town 1 week. I'd been there for years. He knew about a little group that was just getting started, and we wound up going to that group. I walked in, and the only thing I wanted to do was stop drinking. There was a lot of hugging, more hugging than I'd ever seen going on. You couldn't even get in the damn door and somebody's grabbing you and hugging you. And I didn't particularly like physical contact at that time. And they were, it was a strange place. They talked. They told the damnedest things about themselves you've ever heard in your life. Convulsions, imprisonment, car wrecks, stealing airplanes, all kinds of damn things. And every time they told one of these things, everybody just laughed like hell. Most inappropriate sense of humor I'd ever heard of in my life. And they, pretty soon I thought, you know, I'm competitive if I'm nothing else. I just said, hell, I did a couple of things that were kind of cute. I might tell them. So I told them. And they said, looky here, Jerry's opening up. He's beginning to be who he really is. And they said, you know, Jerry, you're living inside your own values. The important values in your life is the greatest freedom there is. Anytime you act outside those values, you're going to feel less for yourself. And if you've been acting outside those values for a long time, you probably don't feel too good about yourself. But you're starting to make a road to recovery, and this is the place to do it. And I began to believe those people might have done it. They seemed to have something there that I hadn't run across. They didn't ask me what my business was. They didn't ask me how much money I made. They didn't ask me whether I didn't have to fill out an application form. I just had to be there. And they welcomed me and asked me questions like, what step are you working on? Well, I don't know. How you feel? Well, see, my feet don't hurt. My knees are okay. Hips feel pretty good. Fine. So they said, no, how you really feel? And they began to talk to me and they began to share with me. And I began to be attracted to the way of life that they had. I recognized the first step. I saw their little funky signs on the wall when I came in. And it was a Sunday school damn deal, and I knew that wasn't going to work, but I didn't have any place else to go. So I kept going. And I recognized that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that from my test. I didn't have alcohol. Alcohol had me. But that unmanageability thing, I'm a senior partner in a large law firm. I'm quick, but I'm not unmanageable. Then one night I was sitting in a meeting and an old boy was talking about something. And it brought to mind a story about my fishbowl. I grew tired of watching television while I was taking the test. It was boring. I couldn't understand a lot of it. My brain was numb. And one day I was in a pet store, and I saw an aquarium. God, that looked good to me. That was a pretty aquarium. I got to watching those fish, and they were pretty, and I wanted one of those aquariums. So I bought me an aquarium. It was my aquarium. And I put that aquarium between my chair and the wall. It had a light on it, my kind of light. It had gravel in it, my color gravel. It had the kind of plants I like, long, leafy plants that kind of reached up to the surface. And I put the kind of fish I wanted in there. Pretty, slow-swimming fish. I could make it daylight, or I could make it dark. I could feed my fish, or there could be a famine upon the land. And I watched my fish, and I would have a little toddy while I was watching my fish, and there was always one fish, though, that night I remembered, who was kind of unruly, kind of an alcoholic fish. He'd begin to swim around and bite the other fish on the tail. And when they did that, they begin to swim faster and they run into other fish. And the damn bowl would just be going crazy and just drive me nuts. I'd reach over and slap the side of that bowl and just let them know that somebody out there, bigger than they were, was unhappy. I gave them three claps of thunder. you would know they would catch on if they had any intelligence at all. To, a higher power did not like what we're doing. There were some who seemed not to be able to catch on to that, so I recognized they needed a hands-on experience with the power. So it got me a little dip net, and I would catch the bad fish. And I would hold him in my lap, keep my hand over the top of the net, and have a drink. Think about those people out there. I'd like to get my dip net on them. You know. And then I'd flip them back in. Now, if you ever do this, timing is really important here. If they float, you've kept them out too long. And so I sat there that night, I thought, my God, you know, I've been thinking my life's manageable, but I can't even run a fishbowl. After the third dip net treatment, I just take them and flush them down the toilet. Nobody knew what was going on in that deal. My son, years later, heard me making a 12-step call on a little gal. He was a doctor, and he'd asked me to come over to the hospital and talk to this young lady, and I was telling her about my fishbowl. And from the back of the room, he wasn't even supposed to be in there. He heard me say I flushed him down the toilet. He said, my God, I wondered where all those fish went. And I suddenly realized, I can't manage a fishbowl. And you know, they've been talking about this self-centered thing. Maybe there's probably not too many 41-year-old lawyers in Dallas who are insulted by the way fish are acting in their fishbowl. That might be self-centered. I'm taking that personal. Fish are controlling my damn life. Had to deal with this God thing. My attitude about God, I didn't know what to think about God. I didn't believe that God was sitting on a cloud somewhere, long beard, white clothes, throwing down lightning bolts when you screwed up, marking a book when you did good. I just didn't believe in that God. Still don't. Still don't believe in that God. I guess that's a theistic God. I don't know what that's supposed to be. But I realized as much spirituality and much God talk was going, hey, I had to resolve this thing in my mind some way or go somewhere else because this was going to be necessary for me to make some kind of a relationship with some power greater than myself. And I told the guys that I didn't have any faith. The preachers I told them about, I don't know whether I believe in God or not. How do you believe in God? And they said, have faith. Have you ever sat in a chair and tried to have faith? Just have some faith? Don't have it. Nothing happened. And they told me that I said, I don't have faith. And they said, we don't care whether you have faith or not. We don't care whether you believe anything or not. What we want you to do is follow the instructions in the book Alcoholics Anonymous and take the steps that are contained there. And we will tell you and assure you, guarantee you, if you do that to the best of your ability, by the time you get to step 12, you will have had a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening of your very own. You won't have to believe what anybody else says. Things will come to you. You'll have insights that you've never had before. I didn't think that'd work, but I didn't have anything else to do. And they were all doing it. They were a bunch of fanatics talking about the steps. So I started trying to do it. I had to define God in a new way. And the way I defined God was to define God as whatever it is that works in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had seen people change in Alcoholics Anonymous by this time. I saw guys come in that couldn't make a complete sentence. And after a month in Alcoholics Anonymous, staying sober, practicing the program, doing whatever, they sobered up to be attractive human beings. So I knew something was working. You could feel it in meetings. Sometimes you could just feel it in meetings. there was some kind of power present. And I didn't talk to anybody about this. I didn't share this much with anybody, but I could feel it. So I define God as whatever it is that works in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I call God today. It goes beyond Alcoholics Anonymous for me today. I know there's a bigger world than this. But there's some power there. There are some values that when you live according to those values, your life is happy, joyous, and free. You have to find what your values are, and you have to live within them, or you'll always be feeling sorry for yourself, less of yourself, and you'll be unhappy. And I begin to look back at the values I had as a kid. I begin to try to live to those values, and I begin to try to pick up whatever they were said in Alcoholics Anonymous were the values. I was very sorry for myself for being an alcoholic. I'd sit around and think about, well, I can't entertain clients anymore. I'll just have to send somebody else to go with my clients to have a drink. They probably won't hire us anymore because I don't take them for a drink. But finally I decided that's just a price, by God, I'm going to have to pay. And we went out, Billy and I were trying to put our marriage back together. And that worked pretty good. We didn't know it going out to this little town of Van out in East Texas in the Piney Woods. And they had a Baptist preacher out there. I'm a Methodist if I'm anything. And I was a little uncomfortable about being with a Baptist. They dunk. You know how they dunk? I wasn't going to be dunked. And sprinkled? Maybe so. I've been sprinkled more than once. But I wasn't going to be dunked. And I went out there, and there were about 10 couples there, none of them that I recognized from Alcoholics Anonymous. They were just civilians. And they we had dinner. Excuse me. We had dinner. And after dinner, we went in this little room and sat down on the floor. Everybody was sitting on the floor, and this guy standing out in the middle of the room. And he said, well, let's get this thing started off in a good way. He said, let's just go around the room and tell what God is doing for you in your life today. Well, that's a testimonial. Baptists do testimonials. Methodists don't do testimonials. I'm not going to talk about that. And I would have left, except I had to get up off the floor or crawl to the door. And Billy's sitting right there beside me, and she ain't going. She's going to stay right there. She's going to talk about what God's doing in her life. So I thought, well, surely somebody will pass, and I will pass. They started around that circle, and they had the damnedest, wimpiest little old problems I'd ever heard in my life. One guy couldn't drive Central Expressway without God. Hell, I'd driven Central Expressway for years, drunker than Cooter Brown. They couldn't raise their kids, though. I had two good kids that I'd raised. I didn't, you know, that didn't impress me at all. They had to, and I got to thinking, geez, this is a kind of wimpy bunch we got here. Nothing like the folks I'm running across in Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I thought, you know, I've been sober 3 months now. I guess something's kept me sober. I guess God's doing that. I guess God's doing that. If I told the Baptist about there was a real alcoholic in their midst who had been sober for 3 months, they'd be impressed as hell. Then I thought, well, I think I'll just tell them. And I looked around the room to be sure I would never see any of those people again. And I don't know what happened for a while there because I was rehearsing my speech. You got to know what you're going to say if you're going to. And so I got my speech pretty well in hand, and a big old boy got up. He was just a pretty woman was sitting here, and my wife was over here, and he was sitting over there, and he was about 6'4", 6'5" inches tall, weighed 250 pounds. had calluses on the back of his knuckles where they drug the ground. You know, the kind of guy I'm talking about. He was a redneck if you ever saw one. And he got up and he was a real man. You could just tell looking at him. And he began to bawl and squall and blow his nose and try to talk. And I was so embarrassed for his wife. My God, would he ever stop and sit down? And he finally got stopped and flopped down in this seat. And I still never did understand what the hell he was talking about. She got up and she was slender. She was pretty. She had gray eyes like my mother's. And she said, I couldn't do it without God. I just couldn't do it without God. He sustains me. Every day, I am sustained by God. I'm going through a hard period in my life now. But the nicest thing about God is He's always going to be available to every human being. And my children who are just 2 and 3, I'm not going to be able to tell them or help them find God. But somebody will. They'll have the opportunity to find and experience God. And as she talked, I realized I was listening to a 32-year-old woman who was talking about dying. She had cancer. She had terminal cancer. She was going to die in a little while. She said, you've noticed how my husband's reacted to this. It's really hard for him. But he'll find somebody else to help him raise our children. Because God doesn't mean that we've got to be joined together at the hip forever. He'll find someone that he can love and that'll love him and he'll love our kids. And he'll go on with his life. And I had a big thought. A great big thought. I didn't know God talked this way, but he said, ain't you got it tough, cowboy? Ain't you got it tough? You've been sitting around these meetings feeling sorry for yourself, sucking your thumb, worrying about whether you could buy drinks for somebody, what you going to do next New Year's Eve because you can't drink, all those goofy thoughts. If that little lady had your opportunity, you've got an incurable disease. Yours is called alcoholism. Hers is called cancer. But if she had your opportunity, and the doctor said, oh, I'm going to give you this opportunity, but I'm going to have to take off both of your legs, she'd said, I'd take it. Just like that. Ain't you got it tough, cowboy? I didn't make a talk that night. I don't have any idea how I got out of that room. The next thing I remember was I was walking among those pine trees with tears strolling down my knees and snot running out my nose, and I was making that old boy inside look like a real He-Man the way I was bawling. And I wasn't bawling because I felt sorry for myself. I was crying because I was grateful. My God, all I had to do was do what these fine people in Alcoholics Anonymous are telling me to do, and I can go anywhere and do anything I was ever supposed to do except drink whiskey. And I guess I never was supposed to drink whiskey. And that night, I think I turned my will and my life over to care of God as I understood Him. It didn't happen all at once, but there was a big shift between self-pity and gratitude. You could feel it. It knocked you to your knees. And that's when I think I took the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. My life has been good. The other steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have helped me fill out my life. And you're going to hear about them. Lee didn't think I knew anything about steps beyond 3, so he just cut me off here at 3. But I've heard of those other steps. They're wonderful, and you're going to have, you know, you're going to hear, you've already heard some fine speakers. The message is here. The action has got to be taken by us. We can't change our lives just by a decision. We've got to hit that bottom, and then we've got to find a way to live free of the values and the past that we've messed up. We've got to use that past and turn it into our greatest asset, our book says. And with that kind of life before us, we can reach people that nobody else can reach. And life is full and life is good. My family is all together. My son came into Alcoholics Anonymous a year or two after I did. And we've been doubly blessed. My daughter has brought all of her children to hear me make an AA talk. And my son has brought his oldest son. And, you know, I couldn't have a better life. I couldn't have a better life. I've had a couple of bouts of cancer. I think God's going to take care of that. I don't know when he's going to pull the cord on my, pull the plug, but you don't either. Know when he's going to pull the plug on you. And I sat around sucking my thumb for a while, feeling because I had cancer, and I got to thinking one day, you know, you're just screwing up one good day after another worrying about what happens in the past. How smart is that? It ain't very smart. So, day at a time, I'm rocking along, and life is treating me a whole lot better than I deserved. And guess what? I don't feel very sorry for y'all either. Thank you.